I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. As the number of confirmed cases of coronavirus in Maryland soars towards 10,000 and healthcare workers scramble to evaluate and address the serious physical needs of these patients, even people who've not been diagnosed with COVID-19 are in need of psychological first aid. The threat of illness, the fear of death, financial anxieties, isolation, grief, and dislocation, all of us are facing unprecedented anxiety and stress. My guest today is Dr. George Everly of Johns Hopkins Medicine. He's one of the country's leading experts in psychological crisis intervention and human resilience. What's the best way to cope at this extraordinary time and to help the people we love get through this difficult period? Dr. George Everly joins me right after the news. Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. The statistics on coronavirus cases here in Maryland continue their inexorable climb. Nearly 9,500 confirmed cases, more than 300 deaths. More than 2,100 people have been hospitalized. And amid the extraordinary levels of physical havoc that have been caused by COVID-19, there is likely an even greater level of psychological consequences for even those among us fortunate enough to have been spared so far by the illness itself. So today we're going to take a look at psychological first aid in times of crisis like this. Dr. George Everly is my guest. He's a pioneer in the field and the co-author of the Johns Hopkins Guide to Psychological First Aid. For more than three decades, he has helped survivors of catastrophes, including wars and natural disasters, terrorist attacks, and now a pandemic. Dr. Everly is a psychologist and an associate professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and an adjunct professor of international health at the Bloomberg School of Public Health. And he writes a blog for Psychology Today called When Disaster Strikes, Inside Disaster Psychology. If you have questions for Dr. Everly, our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. We'd love to hear from you. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Let us know what's on your mind. Let us know the things that are causing you anxiety and stress. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. We really would like to have you involved in our conversation to the extent that you wish to share the story of your experience with COVID-19. Dr. Everly, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Tom. It's a pleasure to be with you today.
So let's start by giving us a little primer. What is psychological first aid?
Well, think of it as a parallel to physical first aid. So physical first aid, it's about stabilizing. It's about attending to acute needs and, if necessary, facilitating access to perhaps higher levels of physical care, medicine, surgery, etc. So the parallel for psychological first aid is simply that this is the very first thing we do. The goals are to keep things from getting worse, perhaps mitigate some acute distress, and in certain circumstances, if further higher levels of care are warranted, to facilitate that access. So it's really just about physical first aid. This is the analog psychological first aid. It's not a treatment. Not a diagnosis. It's not a substitute for treatment.
Yeah, in other words, and it can be administered, as it were, by non-medical professionals. You don't have to be a doctor of psychology or psychiatry to help folks out on this basic level. And as you say, before things may be at a point where, you know, they would require that kind of professional intervention. You know, we hear the term armchair psychologist all the time. You're an actual psychologist. Give us some of the do's and don'ts. In terms of how, if someone presents to us with, you know, who's having some distress, who's having some problems, how can we best help them?
I think the first thing that you can do is simply be present. There are a few things more assuring than the human presence. In fact, research tells us the single best factor predicting human resilience is the support and care of another human being. So being present, sometimes resisting the temptation to try to fix it. A lot of us, I don't know about you, but in my personal and even professional life, sometimes I've, in an effort to try to make it all better, in an effort to live up to that promise where I would say, it'll be okay, I want to rush in and fix it. I want to make it all better. I want to make it go away. And you know what? Sometimes you just can't. So resisting the temptation to rush in and fix it, sometimes just listening to people, you'll find your presence begins to help. But sometimes people will say to you, look, I don't want to talk about it. Okay, honor that. And what you can simply say is, do you mind if I just hang out a while? Do you mind if I'm just here in case you need something? So it really starts with there, with that point, and we call that kind of stabilizing things. When people are very worried, ruminating, sometimes you can give them something to do, something to distract them, engage them, talking about something other than what they're worrying about. Then we get to the area of, well, can I make this a little better? I know I can't fix it, but my target is not the problem in psychological first aid. So if we're dealing with people who are in extreme distress because of COVID, we can't fix the problem, but we can help them deal with the reaction. And that's what psychological first aid is all about. So basically, in the first phase, I ask myself, is there anything I can do in this moment to make things better to the degree that at least they're not getting worse? So I set my expectation pretty low. And then I ask myself a little later, is there anything I can do to make things maybe just a little bit better so that when I walk away, this person will be in a better space? And every once in a while, you realize as you're talking to somebody that they really do need some sort of professional assessment or care. And then my job becomes getting them to that care, advocating for them, serving as a liaison perhaps, getting them to that level of care. And it's not always medical or psychiatric. It could be spiritual care. It could be financial care.
And it sounds like it would be very difficult to self-administer psychological first aid. I mean, if you cut your finger, you can put a Band-Aid on yourself. But it sounds like the importance of talking to somebody, having that person's presence in her life or his life, listening, not interrupting, being calm and reassuring. These are things that you have to do for someone else, and it would be, it seems, on the surface at least, to be a very difficult thing to do for yourself. Is that right?
It is a challenge to do it to yourself, but it can be done. But again, we really do embrace this notion of resilience is facilitated by the presence of another human being, a non-judgmental person, who basically validates your concerns, is there as a compassionate presence.
One of the things that you suggest when you've written about this is that the listener not get caught up in the situation. And that might be a very difficult impulse for people to control. We want to be empathetic, to be empathetic and to have empathy, you sort of have to put yourself in the other person's shoes. We hear that, you know, little rhetorical flourish all the time. What does it mean to not get caught up in the other person's situation?
Well, that's an interesting point, Tom. Some research has actually been done on that issue. There is a phenomenon that's sometimes called compassion fatigue or the cost of caring. And we are taught in the helping professions that empathy, feeling as someone feels, is a mechanism to facilitate their healing. But there's a burden that comes with that. So not only do we have the burden of our own journey through life, but now we're taking the burden of someone else on our shoulders. And if you're helping more than one person a day, you can see this can multiply very quickly. So there's actually been some studies since the 1980s on and trying to answer the question, is there some alternative to getting sucked into someone else's distress, in that abyss of distress? And the answer has been, that has emerged, is something called perspective taking. And the notion of perspective taking is simply trying to see the world through someone else's eyes, absent the emotions that are often attached. In other words, we try to ask ourselves, why is this person experiencing this? Why are they seeing the world this way? And this is a very, very helpful technique, not just in the wake of a pandemic or high-level crisis reactions. It helps sometimes when just something simple, someone does something in traffic that you don't necessarily agree with. And sometimes our impulsive reactions to get very angry. But it's amazing if you say something to yourself, gee, well, I wonder, perhaps that person's not feeling well. Perhaps they're in a rush to go to an urgent care center. Perhaps they're late picking up a child from school. And if you try to put yourself in that person's perspective just for a minute, without the emotion, it serves to explain their behavior. It's hypothetical, of course. But it serves to explain their behavior and take some of the anger away or some of the other angst that you might experience. So research has found that, interestingly enough, the perspective taking seems to be as effective, if not more so, than the empathy. So there may be a way of providing that presence, that compassion, if you will, perceived, without the burden that we normally think of. It's rather exciting research.
My guest is Dr. George Everly. He's the country's leading expert on the notion of psychological first aid. He and a co-author literally wrote the book about it, The Johns Hopkins Guide to Psychological First Aid. It's midday. We'd like to hear from you and your stories as you are experiencing the anxiety and stress that inevitably attends COVID-19 and the coronavirus pandemic. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. A couple of the other things that you do recommend folks do when we're trying to help out folks who are in need. It's okay to try to identify what the worst part of the situation is, if we can, and to not be bashful about asking questions, very serious questions, for example, whether or not the person is thinking about or has intention to harm him or herself. So you're not saying be completely arm's length and dispassionate. You're saying jump in when jumping in appears to you to be the right move.
Absolutely. No hyperbole intended, but it can literally save lives. But the notion of asking a simple question, such as what's the worst part of this, keeps us focused on the other person. Oftentimes, we assume we know what people are going through, and that assumption becomes even more powerful if we have experienced something similar. So we try to help someone, often based on the wrong conclusion in terms of what's plaguing them. So asking a simple question, assuming nothing, just ask the question, what's the worst part of this? And we hesitate to do that because in certain extreme situations, you're afraid someone will say, well, that's a dumb question. Well, as we say in the world of education, there's no such thing as a dumb question. Perhaps it's how you phrase it. So rather than assume you know what's going on, take the little risk and say, look, I know there's all kinds of things going on here. I can't imagine what you're going through. But when you stop and think of it, can you tell me what the worst part of that might be for you? And you'll be amazed at how many times they come up with something that you had never anticipated. And sometimes, Tom, what you'll find is that they have made some sort of catastrophic assumption. They have made some cognitive mistake, and this is the whole basis behind a whole school of thought called cognitive therapy. But it doesn't have to be therapy. Anybody can do this. Sometimes we'll just say, well, that's one way of looking at it. Have you thought of it this way? Not trying to argue, not trying to convince them that you're right, but just giving people alternatives. What stress and crisis does is it takes us out of our comfort zone. It removes safety, a sense of safety. We feel out of control. One of the best things you can do from a psychological standpoint to help someone else is not fix their problem for them, unless, of course, it's something easily fixed, but rather help them help themselves. So we talk about helping people through empowerment, showing them, giving them alternatives. The people that are the most depressed are the people that just feel helpless, hopeless, out of control. Is there anything that you can do to help this person feel a little more in control of their life? And that's sometimes a remarkably powerful intervention that can be done in moments, not hours or days.
Dr. George Everly is an expert in the field of psychological first aid. He's on the faculty of both the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and the Hopkins School of Medicine. Dr. Everly, we're very happy to say, is with us for the hour. We will have more with him after this quick break. You are welcome to join our conversation and share your story of the coronavirus pandemic. 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@WYPR, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. By the way, under the stay-at-home order in effect here in Maryland, if you are leaving your home for an essential reason, like grocery shopping or picking up medicine or getting some outdoor exercise, the CDC has recommended that everyone wear a face mask when out in public, especially on public transportation and while shopping in stores. The mask need not be medical grade. Let's save those for hospital and medical personnel. Handmade cloth masks are fine. Anne Arundel County and Prince George's County are requiring masks by order of their county executives. On Monday night, the Baltimore City Council passed a resolution urging Mayor Jack Young to issue a similar executive order. Bottom line, wear a mask if you're going out. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow on our program, the acclaimed author and journalist Stephen Brill will fact-check the media's pandemic coverage, and we'll have the latest on the Maryland Department of Labor's efforts to keep up with the tremendous surge of unemployment claims. Plus, writer Baynard Woods describes his personal medical odyssey with COVID-19. If you're just joining us today, Dr. George Everly is my guest. He's an expert in the field known as psychological first aid. It's a way of helping people who are traumatized by disasters such as the current pandemic. You are welcome to be part of our conversation, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. If you want to follow me on Twitter, by the way, that's @TomHall. WYPR. So, Dr. Everly, one of the things you suggest when it comes to helping someone out with psychological first aid, the one that I found the hardest one to keep, or would find the hardest one to keep, is you say, don't make promises that you can't keep. Because I think so many of us have, you know, an impulse to give a person a hug, which in many cases we can't do now. We might be doing this psychological first aid on the phone. But we want to say, don't worry, I'll make it okay, I'll fix this, you'll be okay, I'll make sure. But you're saying that's going out on a limb you shouldn't perhaps go out on, huh?
There are exceptions to every rule, Tom, but what we recommend is learning the principles of psychological first aid so that it can help ease another's pain beyond the verbal Hail Mary that we offer when we say something like, everything will be okay. And this gives us some specific tools. We say we want to offer that hug. We want to give that verbal Hail Mary, everything's going to be okay, because we really don't know what else to do. And what psychological first aid is, it's a simple, structured way that's been research-validated to help people feel a little more in control, to let people vent a little bit, get some of that emotional burden off their chest, and help them move forward with a future orientation. And again, this is not therapy nor a substitute for therapy. It's something that can be done in 10 or 15 minutes, typically. It can certainly be longer. It can be shorter. But it gives us a structure, and you mentioned very correctly earlier, try not to get sucked into the abyss that someone else finds themselves in. Don't get sucked into their pain. And if we get sucked into that, then there are two people then now that need psychological first aid. And one way of keeping the emotional distance, some level of objectivity, when we ourselves are stressed, is having some sort of heuristic, some sort of structure, some sort of plan. The antidote for chaos, whether it's physical or psychological, is structure and a plan, and that's what psychological first aid gives us.
David Brooks in the New York Times a few days ago made a plea to listeners or to readers of his column to explain the or describe the mental health challenges that they were encountering, and he writes that one reader said that the pandemic was causing, quote, invisible stress, a pervasive, ever-shifting, hard-to-define anxiety. So Brooks, you know, observes that many people are experiencing even shortness of breath, tightness in the chest, exhaustion. These are symptoms not related to coronavirus, but related to the stress that people are feeling. And you have written, Dr. Everly, about how disasters bring, as it were, psychological casualties that far outnumber the physical ones, right? I mean, we can expect serious mental health consequences in this pandemic, can't we?
I'm afraid that's probably a true statement. The psychological casualties, and what I mean by casualty is someone who can't do what they need to do as a result of the stress that they're experiencing. So that's a psychological casualty. So whether it's earning a living, whether it's taking care of children or parents or just doing what you normally do, even personal hygiene, if that's interfered with, that becomes what we would think of as a psychological casualty. And research over the last 30 years has been very clear that the footprint of psychological casualties will be far, far greater than physical casualties. Some have estimated 4 times as many, some have estimated 50 times as many, 100 times as many. So it's what I've called the hidden pandemic. Those individuals who are psychologically impaired, what they normally can do, they can't do now, and that's part of the issue that we, from a public health standpoint, I think we really do have to prepare for. And the interesting thing, Tom, is that the greatest bolus of group of individuals suffering from this psychological casualty syndrome may not be seen until after the physical threat is actually removed. And some people who do public health planning call that the disillusionment aspect of disasters and crises.
We have an email from a listener named Oren who says, in this pandemic, knowing that thousands are dying and sick, that most of our lives have taken a huge paradigm shift, there's just a great heaviness in the air, even though I'm healthy and still have income. I'm noticing this constant high alert stress buzzing in the background of my consciousness. I'm mentally and emotionally exhausted by 2 o'clock every day, worrying about my older family who are at high risk, my loved ones that are out of work, asking, you know, should I wear a mask or not? Am I washing my hands enough? What can I do just to turn that high alert response off for a while?
Great question. I think the first thing we start with is be kind to yourself, be compassionate with yourself. If there is an opportunity, even for 5 or 10 minutes a day, escape. Sometimes it's a physical escape. It may be a walk. It's just getting from one environment to another environment. Sometimes it's a psychological escape. We know that simple techniques such as mindfulness, for example, what mindfulness basically advocates is wherever you are, whatever you're doing, be in the moment, but don't be distracted by the ruminations, the worries. Research my colleague Dr. Ken Smith and I have been doing for on 30 years now, has shown the most toxic aspect of the human psyche is worry, because your body reacts to something as if it is real every time you worry. So if you worry about something 10 times and it never happens, as sometimes that is the case, right? How many times have we worried about something that never happened? Your body, unfortunately, has had that thing happen to you 10 times. If it finally happens, now it's 11. And ultimately, stress-related illnesses come about because of just wear and tear. We wear down our bodily systems through the hyperdrive, that the adrenaline rush that stress puts on things. But we've actually developed a little bit of a formula to assess the, for lack of a better term, the psychological toxicity of certain events, and pandemic, of course, being one of them. Hurricanes, floods could also be things. And we basically say the psychological toxicity is a function of the lethality of the event, the chronicity of the event, how long does it last, and we also think about ambiguity, interestingly enough, uncertainty. So if we say an event that is high on all three factors would be the most psychologically toxic event you could be exposed to, guess what?
Yeah, we're in it.
We're in it.
And that is a really important point, that this pandemic is fundamentally different than 9/11. I mean, you spent 10 months working in New York, giving training and counseling to first responders. But it's different than 9/11. There was this horrible incident of the planes crashing into the buildings and in the field in Pennsylvania and at the Pentagon. But then it was over. A hurricane is over. All of a sudden, 2 days later, the sun's out. A flood eventually is over and the water recedes. But we have no notion at all of when a pandemic like this is going to be over, or if it will ever be over. So that's a very different kind of unique kind of stress in this particular instance. What are your thoughts about how to tailor psychological first aid to this moment?
Well, great question, Tom. The mistake that a lot of our colleagues make is they think the psychological interventions, going back to our earlier comments, have to fix the problem. It doesn't. It has to attend to the response to the problem. So what I say to people is, look, there are very few things in the world that you really, truly can control, and the pandemic is not on that list. But what you can always control is how you react to something. So psychological first aid, just helping another person in any form or fashion, should be targeted toward the response. You've raised an interesting issue. This thing may recycle. Dr. Fauci has suggested that there's a possibility that it may come in waves. It could be seasonal. That's waiting for the other shoe to drop. Well, that's that worry thing again. So if you think it's going to come again, think about this. If you think it's going to come again, there's really no relief from surviving it the first time, because you're always waiting. You're hypervigilant. You're scanning for threats. You go to the grocery store, which our grocery store has now one-way aisles, and you see someone going down the aisle the wrong way. And you think to yourself, uh-oh, is this safe? You know, what are they doing? And you get a little angry, perhaps. You can't control that person, but you can control your reaction to that person, psychologically and behaviorally. So maybe you choose to wait for that person to get out of the aisle. And again, do the perspective taking, which basically says, look, they're as stressed out as I am, and no one is necessarily thinking at their top game. So, you know, be forgiving, be compassionate.
Dr. George Everly is my guest. He's with the Bloomberg School of Public Health and the School of Medicine at Johns Hopkins. We're talking about psychological first aid. Our number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wipr.org, and you can tweet us at Midday. WYPR. Dr. Everly, we have a email from Jean who says, I often find that writing a journal entry helps ease my anxieties. Sometimes I find that after I write the entry, I ceremoniously tear the paper up and throw it away. Have you found in your work that journaling is a helpful tool?
Journaling is a wonderful tool. There's actually research out of the University of Texas by James Pennebaker that has shown that writing in a journal, you don't have to share it with anybody, but writing daily about your stressors, the things that go well as the things that go poorly, can be remarkably health-promoting. He has found that it helps people recover from some physical illnesses more rapidly. He's found that it's helped people who were unemployed get reemployed more rapidly than control groups. And he even found that under stressful conditions where your immune system becomes suppressed, he found that it actually elevated the immune system and made people less vulnerable to infectious diseases or colds or whatever. They didn't linger as long. So yes, journaling is a wonderful thing.
We have an email from John who says, this is a small sample size, but here on the ground, I know drinking has skyrocketed amongst myself and the people I know. These are professionals, teachers, and service sector employees. I've had two sessions with my therapist since the shutdown, and it's hard to know where to even begin. I'm guessing there's a ton of psychological damage happening that we aren't even seeing yet. You've written, Dr. Everly, about resilience. I remember, you know, after the Boston Marathon bombing, we had the T-shirts and the logo for Boston Strong. Even after the uprising and violence here in Baltimore 5 years ago, we talked about the resilience of the city of Baltimore. And Andrew Cuomo and Bill de Blasio talk about the resilience of New Yorkers as they are, you know, at the epicenter of the pandemic right now. Is resilience, you know, possible even in collective groups or even... is it possible learned? Is it a learned skill that an individual can have? What is resilience and how do you get it?
So resilience is the ability to bounce back from adversity. Very simply said, that's the denotation in the English language. But we have expanded it to the point that we say resilience is the ability to develop some psychological immunity to the stress of adversity, as well as the ability to bounce back. So we think of it as a two-pronged phenomenon. So I wanted to study people that I thought were highly resilient. So I had the opportunity to study U.S. Navy SEALs. And I wanted to see if their resilience and immunity was genetic or was it something that was acquired, learned, and the answer definitively was yes, a little of both. So the good news for me as a psychologist is that I could begin to research what the factors were that made people personally resilient. We discovered the factors that helped leaders help others be resilient. In other words, we call it resilient leadership. There are certain leadership characteristics that actually empower and instill resilience in those who follow. And lastly, we found that resilience was most powerfully instilled within groups. And as I mentioned, the support of other people, interpersonal support, social support, is the single best predictor of human resilience. And Darwin told us that 150 years ago. And he said, groups, communities, societies that are cohesive, working to a particular end, striving for the same basic goal, in this case, it's survival from pandemic, tend to do more things successfully and tend to survive as a group compared to groups that are divisive and fighting within themselves. So one of the things that we do is we try to build community cohesion, group cohesion. And that's what's happening, for example, at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and Johns Hopkins Hospital, where there is very there's a very active initiative to supporting the real heroes, which are the healthcare frontline personnel, putting their happiness, their well-being, and that of their families on the line to take care of other people. So we are trying to foster resilience within those groups as well.
Dr. George Everly is on the faculty of the Bloomberg School of Public Health and the School of Medicine at Johns Hopkins University. He's the co-author of the Johns Hopkins Guide to Psychological First Aid, and he writes a blog. It's a terrific blog. It's for Psychology Today, and it's called When Disaster Strikes, Inside Disaster Psychology. We'll have more with Dr. Everly on the other side of this quick break. You are welcome to join us, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. Before we go to a break, this update on the April 28th election that will choose a successor to the late Congressman Elijah Cummings in the 7th Congressional District. The State Board of Elections has changed its mind about polling centers. Most voters will vote by mail in this election, but the board announced yesterday that there will be 3 in-person polling centers, one in Baltimore City, one in Baltimore County, and one in Howard County, for people who are not able to vote by mail. The board encourages everyone who does not have a disability or another reason that they can't vote by mail to, in fact, do that. Postmark your ballots no later than April 28th. But the election board has decided to add 3 centers, the locations of which will be announced no later than April 20th. That's a change from what I announced yesterday, because the board just met yesterday and they changed their minds. Ballots were mailed to 7th District voters at the beginning of April. Linnell and I live in the 7th District. We just received ours yesterday. If you don't receive a ballot in the next few days, call the Board of Elections or go online to be sure you receive one in time to vote. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. It's Procol Harum. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
I'm Tom Hall, and I add my thanks to Nathans for making Midday possible and for joining us today on our program. We're talking today about psychological first aid, the things that we can all do to tend to the psychological needs of ourselves and others during traumatic events like this coronavirus pandemic. My guest is Dr. George Everly. He spent 10 months in New York following the 9/11 attacks, counseling and training first responders. The coronavirus has created the same kinds of problems of anxiety and fear that 9/11 survivors experience, but what makes it different from events like 9/11 is that with the virus, there is no clear end date. Unlike a terrorist attack or a hurricane or a flood, COVID-19 is a constant threat at the moment that doesn't go away when the weather improves or the attack site is cleaned up. But Dr. Everly says that the principles of psychological first aid can still be applied to help people address the psychological effects that attend the coronavirus pandemic. You are welcome to participate in our conversation with George Everly, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And Dr. Everly, we have an email from Patricia who says, echoing what I've just been talking about there, we have no idea when this will be over or whether it will even become unthinkably worse before it's over. And they're worrying about things like, will we have enough food and will any of our family members die? It's the unknown that makes the worry so much greater, Patricia writes. So hard to deal with the magnitude of the unknown. There are different phases for these kinds of psychological challenges. The magnitude is of a different order, as we've said, than, you know, a hurricane or a flood or something. But we're in there are different phases. I guess we're in what you would call the impact heroic phase of the pandemic right now. What does that mean?
Yeah, I think that's probably where we are, and we will be until the zenith, the spike, the greatest number of cases is realized. So the rather predictable phases, surprisingly to many, transcend different types of disasters, different cultures. It's all the same. I've been to 39 countries on 6 continents, and the phases for a hurricane, for a terrorist attack, for a war, they're pandemics. This is my 3rd pandemic. They're all the same. But what we can't do is tell you how many days or months within each. So we start with the impact. That's when people are first diagnosed, and there's confusion, there's fear, there's anxiety, there's even denial. How many times have we heard people saying, well, this is not going to be a problem, or it's not a problem that's going to affect me? It's not just the pandemic we see in denial. How many times have you heard of a hurricane coming, and the person who has a condominium right on the beach says, you know, I'm just going to ride this one out? And sometimes it turns out okay, and sometimes not so much. But the impact is... And you've made these points very well, Tom. The tornado, it's over and done with in moments, maybe an hour, but then it's done. So the impact, we're still in the impact phase. And then what's coming with the impact is the heroism that we see during the impact and shortly thereafter, where people are riding this adrenaline rush. And the goals are self-preservation and preservation of other lives, and sometimes preservation of property, but it's all about preservation. You can only ride an adrenaline rush so long, and then we begin to see the compassion fatigue, the burnout, sometimes even vicarious trauma sneaking in there. So we don't know how long this is going to last, other than the epidemiologists are telling us we'll probably see the spike in the next week or two in Maryland. And then we'll know what we've been through, and then it's downside. And that's where the disillusionment, and people will stand around sometimes and they'll say, look, I'm don't get me wrong, I'm happy that I survived, I'm happy we got through this, but you know what, the economics, I'm out of work, or I've had to drain my 401k, or it's going to be really hard to recover, and God forbid you lost someone close to you. You lost a loved one. Why did this have to happen? And that's where disaster mental health, the whole field, which is a nascent field, it was probably born around 1992, that's where disaster mental health interventions, psychological first aid being one of them, probably the most commonly used, that's where we try to bridge the gap. We try to help people move from the disillusionment to moving on, to reconstruction. And there's one little bump in the road that we can usually anticipate, and that's what we call an anniversary reaction. So people are doing okay, and then the anniversary of the impact comes along, and it knocks people back. But people recover, and they move on, and they build new lives. And I think one of the most important things to remember, Tom, when we get frustrated, anxious with the uncertainty, part of the problem, remember, control what you can, cope with what you can't control. And one of the ways to cope is to understand that this is a journey. It's not a destination. I hate to be trite, but it's really true. If you're waiting with bated breath for the end to come, especially given what the virologists and epidemiologists are suggesting, that this may be a wave pattern. It may be seasonal. We just don't know. If that is indeed the case, you can see how you set yourself up for disappointment and failure. But on the other hand, if you see this as a journey, a difficult one, yes, but a journey that we have to make, and we can make it together, then we remove the notion, it protects us from disappointments and failure. We draw strength from the fact that wherever you are and whatever you do, you're part of something greater than yourself. And that's where we get the strength of a community.
We have an email from a listener, Jackie. And Jackie, I'm really glad that you wrote in. Jackie writes, I've suffered from anxiety acute at times and depression for pretty much my entire life, and this pandemic has put me in a very scary place. Before this, I always knew if things got out of control, I could go somewhere like an ER. That's not necessarily possible right now. I have no family and not many friends. The people in my life who are around me are bothered by my angst. Jackie writes, I'm terrified of dying, especially of anything that inhibits my ability to breathe, and not knowing when this will end prevents me from seeing any hope. She writes, I'm lost, afraid, and alone. Well, Jackie, I'm glad you wrote. I'm glad you're listening. And Dr. Everly, it's very difficult to be in relationship to a person on the radio, but what would you say to Jackie right now?
First thing I'd say is, Jackie, you're not alone. There are resources and people around you that care about you, and they don't even know you, perhaps. It's hard taking that first step, but given the fact that it feels like it's alone, it's a very scary place, it's a panicky place, but there are people out there who are willing to help you, and they don't even know you, and you can draw some strength from that, but sometimes, especially if you're isolated, you have to take the first step. You have to reach out to people. And there may be, I'm not sure where she lives, but there may be telephone crisis hotlines that she can call into. But don't be discouraged just because some people may not have tolerance for the anxiety or the fear that you're experiencing. You have every right to feel that way. They're your reactions. But Jackie, you're not alone.
And thanks for writing in, Jackie. We appreciate it, and we're thinking about you. Let's see if we can get one call in. We just have a couple minutes left. Let's go to Ed in Baltimore. Ed, welcome to Midday with Dr. George Everly.
Hello.
Yes, sir. You're on the air. What's your question?
My question is, where does grief fit into your practice of first aid for your problems? I'm just wondering, it's a change of pace, but is grief fall into any of these categories for you to treat?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. Thanks, Ed.
Well, yes, a great question. So we are likely to experience rather remarkable grief reactions in the disillusionment phase as we move past this acute impact of the pandemic. Psychological first aid can be very helpful in terms of helping people recognize grief that perhaps they can't manage on their own and really do need some professional assistance with. But it can sometimes accelerate the grief process. One of the things we've learned over the years is that grief is best attended in many cases with just time. Time does heal. The challenge is remembering that when you're going through it and not being drawn deeper into that abyss of grief. So psychological first aid can help take the edge off, take some of the sting out. It's not going to cure the problem. Time generally is helpful, and certainly professional care, perhaps talking to other people who have been through the grieving process. And psychological first aid can often accelerate one's willingness to move on to professional levels of assistance if they seem indicated.
Dr. George Everly is the co-author of the Johns Hopkins Guide to Psychological First Aid. He also writes a blog for Psychology Today magazine called When Disaster Strikes, Inside Disaster Psychology. And we've got a link to the blog on our website, wipr.org/midday. Dr. Everly, thank you so much for your time today and your wonderful perspective. Very, very much appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom.
That's it for us today. Our coverage of the COVID-19 pandemic continues tomorrow with a conversation about media coverage of the pandemic with the journalist and author watchdog Stephen Brill. We'll also look at the economic impact on businesses, individuals, and state and local governments, plus a firsthand account of what it's like to have serious COVID-19 illness. The journalist Baynard Woods describes his experience, which luckily has worked out well. He's feeling okay, and he will join us tomorrow here on Midday. Here and Now is up next after the news. Be sure to catch the podcast, The Daily Dose. That's our collection of reporting from WIPR about the coronavirus. I'm Tom Hall. Very much appreciate your listening. We'll talk again tomorrow. We'll be right back.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.